Everything Nicholas Snow is available at nicholassnow.com. For our video programming, check out nicholassnow.tv. Please subscribe to the show for free at iTunes or by downloading a podcast app from your favorite app store. Are you ready for a snowstorm of global proportion? Yes, over 6 feet of snow has just hit your podcast experience. And here he is, Nicholas Snow.
Hey, everybody. It's September 24th, 2015 at 4 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. But this show remains available forever. So whenever you're listening, thank you. This show is titled Zen and the Art of Dying. It's a film. It's a movie. It's a documentary. The film's director is Broderick Fox, known by his friends as Brody. But this movie and this episode is much more about life than death, and it's about being powerful. So, regarding Zen and the Art of Dying, it looks at the life of Zen Virago, an activist and educator for over 20 years has been leading Australia towards a more communal, celebratory, and creative engagement with death and dying. From her origins as a young mother in the UK to her present-day identity as a lesbian, feminist, and self-described death walker in the idyllic seaside town of Byron Bay, Zenith's personal and professional experience quietly challenge our core assumptions about life and dissolve our taboos around death. More information on the film and natural death care movement it models can be found at zenandtheartofdying.com. But let's listen to the audio for the film's trailer. And in a few minutes, I'll bring on the air the film's director, Broderick Fox, called Brody by his friends.
This is one of the best places to live, but it's also a great place to die.
This is such an exciting night. I can't think of another place that it would be more fitting to premiere this film.
As a feminist, as a lesbian, as a woman, as a mother.
Deathwalker!
I bring all of that richness.
So can I ask how many people have actually seen a real dead body, not something on TV?
Okay, what am I going to do now? It's like that major flip out that, who do I call?
You know? Experiencing it and seeing that it's not a scary thing.
Because we had conversation all the way through, really all that was left to say in the end was thank you and I love you.
Yes, we did it. And we did them proud and we did the best we could. It wasn't perfect, but we did it.
Death is a great teacher, just like life. Once you know it, you can't unknow it.
We're all going to shout out one thing together.
What is it?
Well, it could either be life or it could be love. What do you reckon?
The snowstorm continues after this.
Spotlight on Palm Springs.
Come to Lulu, the award-winning California bistro. Fabulous breakfast, a luscious three-course Sunday brunch. Rumptious dinners serving fresh fish, perfect steaks, pizzas, salads, and more. Something for everyone. A three-course special to savor from $15.99. The best all-day and night happy hour. There's always a party at Lulu in the heart of downtown Palm Springs on South Palm Canyon and Arenas.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Snow. Many of you know that I am HIV positive. I'm living powerfully with HIV because I benefit from the services of the Desert AIDS Project in Palm Springs, California. And I'm very happy to bring you this news from another grateful client of Desert AIDS Project.
I'm more proactive with my health now, I think, than I was before. And I think that's because there's other people that are being proactive with me. You know, there's people that are interested and concerned about it.
A lot of services that are very difficult to access to HIV-infected patients are gathered within one roof. We do have access to substance abuse counselor, mental health services, psychiatrists. We have dental service programs. We have nutritional programs, housing, case management. Very unique in the nation that all the programs, including medical services, are administered within one facility.
Coming here, I felt just an amazing amount of love from Desert AIDS Project. They are people who just care in the community, people who want to put a hand out and say, let me hold yours. And I think that makes all the difference in the world.
For more information, visit desertaidsproject.org.
And now, on with the show. He's a regular contributor to the Huffington Post and to media outlets throughout the world. He's an author, singer, songwriter, actor, and activist, and the executive producer and host of NicholasSnow.tv. He has created and continues to do so a snowstorm of global proportions dedicated to connecting the circuitry of humanity. And now, drifting into the studio and your life once again, Nicholas Snow.
And over 6 feet of snow has just hit your podcast experience. Broderick Fox's award-winning narrative, experimental, and documentary works present challenging, socially relevant issues through accessible, character-driven storytelling and have screened in over 50 international festivals. Fox's last feature documentary, The Skin I'm In, and premiere at the Byron Bay International Film Festival in Australia, where he met Zenith Virago. She was an audience member who approached him after the screening, and their shared sensibilities and interests precipitated an immediate connection. Also a media scholar and professor, Fox had been thinking and writing critically about digital media production as a means of illness or injury-related pain management, bereavement, and empowerment in end-of-life decision-making. The chance to document Virago's work as both a queer woman and a death walker felt like a natural, exciting, and passionate next step in his filmmaking. The production crew for Zen and the Art of Dying consisted only of Fox as cinematographer-director and his husband, Lee Biolos, a sound recordist and producer. With this small footprint, they embedded with Zenith for 5 weeks, during which she and the community of Byron Bay offered up access to some of their most intimate and vulnerable moments, doing death differently. Fox was one of 12 California artists awarded a 2014 Artistic Innovation Grant from the Center for Cultural Innovation in support of Zen and the Art of Dying. He is an associate professor of media arts and culture at Occidental College in Los Angeles, where he teaches courses in both theory and production. His book, Documentary Media, History, Theory, Practice, is now out through Focal Press. Welcome to the studio, Broderick Fox. Hey, Brody, how's it going?
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thanks for being here. You know, I had the opportunity to see your film over the weekend. I have yet to mention in this episode that one of the things that this series of my show have in common is that all of my guests were selected as part of the 2015 Palm Springs LGBTQ Film Festival, known as Cinema Diverse. For information about that festival, you can always go to cinemadiverse.org. It's an annual event. But in any rate, Brody, I got to screen your film with you and your husband in a theater with a decent-sized, very appreciative and moved audience. But before I even saw the film, there's something that really impressed me about you, and I'm wondering if you get this other feedback. What impressed me about you in our private conversations before the film is that you are an excellent listener.
Well, that's lovely to be able to, for you to be able to say. I mean, I take that as a documentary filmmaker, I take that as a real compliment, particularly with this film in which I was asking people, strangers, to really open up about some of their most vulnerable and intimate moments around bereavement and loss and death. I think it really is my responsibility as a maker to create a space with the camera, but also through my interaction with the subjects, a space of listening where people actually have the opportunity to be able to tell their story.
Well, when I had a conversation with you and your husband, Lee, in the parking lot, and you were no longer talking to me, you were talking to someone else in our group, I was taken by how much attention and focus you were giving my friend just in a casual conversation. You weren't distracted by anything or anyone around you, and you were there for him and for the people that you're interacting with. And it just stood out to me as a very powerful skill that you possess.
Oh, well, thanks. That's great to hear. I mean, your friend is an interesting guy. He's working in a related sort of death care field. So I was really excited to hear what he was doing, because one of my interests with this film is to, I mean, certainly it's about Zenith and about a particular community in Australia, but people are doing this kind of natural death care work around the globe. And so I'm always excited to hear how other people are connecting with figuring out ways for us to do death differently and to try to reconnect with some of these traditions that we've certainly in America have kind of lost connection to or handed over to a lot of commercial and medical forces in the last century, and have become sort of afraid of and disconnected from in a lot of respects.
In the information that I shared earlier in the show, the material mentions that what Zenith is doing ties into some of your own study of media, and I'm wondering if you could elaborate a bit more on what you were studying and working on, and how it did connect with the theme of your what would be your next documentary.
Yeah. So basically, I guess if I think about all the work I've made and the kinds of things I think about as a scholar, I'm really looking at ways in which particularly emergent digital technologies, these consumer technologies that we're now all increasingly being able to access on our phones, or the editing software we can access on our computers, the means to share information or share media through social media and through the internet. I'm interested in looking at ways in which that kind of democratizes production and the kinds of stories that people can tell. Quite often stories that have maybe been left out of mainstream representation. So a lot of my work in the past has actually been autobiographical, kind of telling stories around sexual identity, around questions of addiction, et cetera. And I'm really interested in kind of the limit case of that in some respects, which is people who are using these technologies to tell stories around illness and death and dying. In a lot of respects, you know, we've made a lot of progress in American culture along registers of sex and sexuality and sexual orientation and identity. And in some funny ways, death is death and aging and illness. I would say sort of the triumvirate of those two things are sort of the final bodily taboos in America. And so I was looking at ways in which people are telling their stories when they're sick on Facebook, or by actually even collaborating with filmmakers to document their own illness and demise. I mean, in the queer film canon, I think a lot of your listeners may remember well, and this is pre-digital, the really sort of amazing work Silver Lake Life, The View from Here, which was a collaborative autobiography made by Tom Joslin and Mark Massey, and then ultimately, as they became too sick with late manifestations of AIDS to continue filming, that one of Tom's film students took over the enterprise in making this documentary. And it was one of the first documentaries from 1991 that really humanized and put a face to AIDS and to a gay couple going through it. And that was one of the most profound sort of early documentary experiences that I had as a gay man coming into my own. And so I've been really amazed at the power of media to tell, put a face to stories that might not necessarily otherwise be seen. And so it's those kinds of works, both pre-digital and digital, that I was writing about and thinking about. And so when I met Zenith, as you said in your intro, a woman who is sort of a compelling queer character who is also queering death and taking an entire community through the way in which we think about death and dying, it seemed like a really exciting way to merge my interests and to find inspiration for my next project.
Well, based upon that answer, you must be aware of the film Paul Monet, The Brink of Summer's End.
No, I'm not. You've given me something to watch.
Oh, you definitely have to. You definitely need to watch that movie, Paul Monet, The Brink of Summer's End. Are you familiar with Paul Monet?
I'm embarrassed to say I'm not. So tell
okay,
me about
well, that. You will be really, really fascinated by him. He won the National Book Award for Borrowed Time, an AIDS memoir. Mm-hmm. He also won a Lambda Literary Award. His life and death are very much related to your work and teaching. So I, by all means, check his legacy out.
Great.
The other thing that I think is that I asked you in the Q&A, actually in our conversation in the parking lot and in the Q&A, in response to someone else, you used the word queering. And I'd love for you to let my listeners know what you mean by use of the word queering.
Yeah, that's a great question. As we all know, the word queer for a long time was a derogatory or a pejorative term. It was used as a form of hate speech, as a way to sort of describe people whose sexual orientations or sexual identifications or gender identifications were outside of sort of mainstream heterosexual norms and cultural values, as it were, putting values in quotes. A range of activists, through the ACT UP movement and things like that, really reappropriated that term. You know, the whole really amazing adage, you know, we're here, we're queer, get used to it, sort of took the power back in that term. Academic theorists, queer theorists, have really sort of developed a whole sort of discipline of queer theory that certainly has its origins in sort of questions of sexuality, but really gets down to the larger argument that that about questioning any assumption that there is a norm or a standard from which other things are queer. And so the idea of queer theory is that that we can actually queer or question any assumption about culture. So queering notions of gender performances, queering notions of any sort of register of belief system. So in that sense, I enjoy and increasingly use the word queer as a verb, talking about queering something or queering a text or queering an idea, to really sort of say that we're going to question any assumed norms or presumptions and go back to square zero and really look at something fresh for the first time and ask, you know, what is really intrinsically true or what is possible and what sort of valuations or beliefs have been sort of imposed from outside that are actually the beliefs, the culturally constructed beliefs or personally constructed beliefs of an individual or a nation or a particular cultural moment. So I use it as a celebratory term and as a term of really kind of hopefully inspiring an idea of questioning and investigation. So when I talk about Zenith queering death, I mean by that that she is asking some questions and assumptions about the particular roles that we're supposed to perform as people who are dying or who are dealing with the loss of somebody. all these sorts of supposed rules about what you can and can't do to care for someone at home, or to even sort of care for and keep and take care of a dead body after somebody has died. Having the right or the choice to build your own coffin rather than having to spend thousands of dollars on some lead-lined casket. So she's sort of questioning and shifting all of those perhaps assumptions that people think are laws or absolutes, but when you really look more closely, are basically just things that have progressively emerged out of cultural habit.
I had a public access TV show in LA from 1993 until the year 2000 called Tinseltown's Queer. So I personally have been queering media for decades, but I love the way that you use the word and wanted my audience to benefit from the background information that you've just provided. I'd love to know, because I feel like there's this magical story based upon what he shared briefly in the Q&A, or one of you did, how you met your husband.
Well, in a way, this film is absolutely a product of my own personal relationship. So my partner, Lee, is an Anaheim boy by birth who... as a young person, went off exploring the world and wound up in Australia, and was there for 22 years, and really thinks of that as a home for a lot of the ways in which the environment there, the nature, the quality of life, the attitude of the people there. So he happened to come back for a brief gig about 8 years ago in the U.S. and met me and ended up getting stuck here with me. But Australia is very much still a huge part of his life, and I've now had the opportunity to create my own relationships there. But when I finished my last film, The Skin I'm In, he said, well, you've got to submit to the Byron Bay International Film Festival. Byron Bay is the most beautiful place I know on earth. And so we submitted, and they were the first people to say yes to that film. And we traveled there for the world premiere. And as you sort of cited in your introduction, the rest is history. Zenith was an audience member at that screening and came up to me and introduced herself afterwards. And as a result, my relationships to Australia and its people have deepened through the making of this film.
I can't believe that you used the language that your husband is now in the United States with you. you're a relatively young, creative, educated, articulate, handsome mover and shaker. So how could anyone be stuck with you?
We love LA too. I mean, LA, there's so much going on in Los Angeles where we live. It's actually a really exciting moment for Los Angeles, along particularly around visual art. There's a real kind of an exciting movement that's happening here. So I say stuck sort of glibly. I'm grateful for the life we have here as well. And it's great to be able to
see
bi-national too.
bi-national. Okay. So next up, I'm going to talk about a giant tattoo and a near-death experience that is also part of Brody's history. About which I know very little, so I'm going to discover it with you.
Everything Nicholas Snow is available at nicholassnow.com. For our video programming, check out nicholassnow.tv. Please subscribe to the show for free at iTunes or by downloading a podcast app from your favorite app store. The snowstorm continues after this.
Designer furnishings, sparkling cocktail rings, vintage jeans and shirts for moms, teens, boys, and flirts. Aerial rugs and stylish bedding, design your wedding. Shiny knickknacks and glam Hollywood throwbacks. You'll find it here at Revival. Voted best of the Valley thrift stores. Now with even more new treasures, plus one-of-a-kind consignment and estate items. Fashion, accessories, furniture, it's all in store at Revival. Find it here. Visit us at revivalstores.com to find a Revival store near you.
Hey folks, mark your calendars for early November because it's time for Greater Palm Springs Pride, Southern California's popular and longest-running LGBT festival in the Coachella Valley. Palm Canyon Drive is closed to traffic and transformed into a vibrant, pedestrian-friendly Pride festival unique to Southern California. Palm Springs Pride is also one of the sponsoring organizations of the annual Harvey Milk Diversity Breakfast, which takes place every year in May. Visit pspride.org.
The LGBT Community Center of the Desert is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enriching the lives of the LGBT community in the Valley through health and wellness, social and educational programs. The center advances its mission through a clinical counseling and internship program, senior programming, youth anti-bullying and suicide prevention support programs, a growing volunteer program, and signature special events in the community for its members and allies. For more information on the LGBT Community Center, visit them on the web at thecenterps.org.
Broderick, before the break, I alluded to your first documentary, but before we actually talk about that, I would love to for you to respond to my opinion that your current film, Zen and the Art of Dying, is really much more about life than it is about death.
I think that's a really great way to look at it. I mean, when I tell people I'm making a film about changing attitudes around death, I get two simultaneous reactions, a kind of recoiling, but then also, once we get past that, a real immediate connection. I mean, I don't think I've gone from zero to 60 in terms of conversations with people faster than around this film, because everybody does have some sort of encounter or experience with death and loss. And quite often, those experiences have been negative ones in terms of how caring for somebody in their late moments in life in a hospital, or having to have a funeral that didn't necessarily make them feel much better than when they went into it, or made them just feel financially strapped. Some of those experiences are negative. So, you know, this film is certainly about trying to show alternatives to that, to regain control and power and agency in those moments. But in doing so, it's really making the message that if we embrace death as an essential part of the life cycle, then it sort of it loses its strength as a source of fear, but rather is truly a part of the life cycle and the experiencing of life. And that is, the film is really a portrait of this woman, Zenith Burago, and her journey to get to doing this sort of work that she calls death walking. And really the message with her is to live a full life, a fully questioned life where one is really honest with themselves, and a life without regrets. And that makes for a good death. A fully lived, truly experienced life means that one can die peacefully. So I think it is a celebratory film that is very much about life.
Well, I would concur, and I thought it was just a really beautiful film. And you are so understated in the way that you show up in the world. There's nothing pretentious about you, in my opinion. And so I went into your film without having anyone really build it up for me. I mean, you knew that you said it was showing, and I got to see it. But it's always wonderful to go and discover that something is actually really brilliant and moving when it could be so many different things.
Well, thank you. Well, we just started our festival journey, so hopefully it'll be at a festival, around the globe in the coming year, and then we'll get it out there on online and things like that, and try to share it with the widest audience possible.
When was the first time you saw Zen and the Art of Dying with an audience that was not comprised of family and friends, and what was the reaction?
Well, our premiere was taking it back to the town of Byron Bay for the Byron Bay International Film Festival in March of this year, in March 2015. And that was, on one hand, that was home court. I mean, so a community that knows Zenith and her work. On the other hand, it was a scary experience because this was the community that I had documented, who had entrusted me with their stories. And so, you know, of course, my hope is that they would have responded well to the film, that they would feel that I'd done them and Zenith's work justice. The other interesting thing is that Zenith chose not to watch the film in advance. She said she ultimately decided she would watch it live at the premiere with her tribe, as she called them, with the community. So that was scary for me too, because the film, you know, obviously she knows the information she shared with me during the filming, but there's a lot of personal information and personal choices about her life in there. And there were a lot of stakes to how that screening would go. And I have to say, it was very well received there. Zenith is pleased and proud of the film, and the community was pleased. And many of the families of people who passed on in the film, or who shared their stories with people who had passed on in the film, were there. So it was a pretty powerful and moving night. It was neat to show it at Cinema Diverse last weekend, though, with an American audience, so not an Australian audience, and also an audience who's not familiar with Zenith and her work. And it seemed like the film really does translate, that her work, the possibilities of it, and the spirit of the film kind of transcended that community, which is great, because the community of Byron Bay is the community where all the Australian hippies went to drop out in the 60s. So they're quite cosmopolitan and really interesting and complex there, but they already are a community who is open to looking at things differently and trying different things. And one of the big questions is, you know, can these ideas translate to the big city or to other country contexts? And I think they can. I think the response is showing that people are hungry for something different around some of these major life moments.
Zen's backstory is fascinating.
Yeah, she's a pretty compelling woman. You know, part of the film is kind of interesting to sort of see the twists and turns of that story, but yeah, she's UK born, but kind of went on a real search of her own, traveling the world and winding up in Byron Bay. Was a paralegal who really got into this work caring for dead because a good friend of hers died, and she just instinctively felt, looking at the body in the morgue, that she didn't want to leave it there, and she didn't want to hand it over to a funeral director. That she said, you know, we can do this ourselves. So she found a wonderful funeral director who was actually willing to walk her through the steps, and she took the body home, and she and her friends washed it and dressed it, and they built a coffin, and they got it to the crematorium in their own vehicles with a few sort of snafus and difficulties trying to fit their coffin in the car, and performed their own service. And by the end of that period, they felt certainly still sad at the loss of their friend, but incredibly energized and released, in a way, the fact that they've been able to journey through their grief together with the body rather than forfeiting those experiences. And really from there, people started saying, can you do that for us? Can you do our funeral? Can you help us? And so then she took her legal knowledge, what are the actual laws in Australia around caring for your own dead or transporting for your own dead, and combined that with some emotional and spiritual aspects, and arrived at the kind of work and consultation that she's now doing for a lot of people, but also training Australians to do for themselves.
Well, that's very, very impressive, and I loved the film. The official website is zenandtheartofdying.com. What is the term, the natural death care movement? What exactly does that mean?
Yeah, so that's a term that's not my own. It's one that's starting to be used to describe what is an international movement now of people who are kind of working to sort of bring greater choice in end of life decision making. And so it's a range of funeral workers, mortuary workers, physicians, palliative care physicians, nurses, spiritual figures, et cetera, who are all collaborating to think about different ways to repersonalize and reconnect to death and dying. So I've got a section on the website that kind of describes it and also kind of charts a little bit of its history. In a way, it came from a baby boomer generation who started the national childbirth movement of their own, and wanted to sort of personalize and return the process of childbirth to the home or outside of sort of the medical forces. And now, you know, those same baby boomers are getting older and they want to do death their own way too. So that it sort of makes sense in a way that they're calling this the natural death care movement. Zenith, I'll say though, is the first to say that all the things she's doing are not things that she made up by any stretch of the imagination. None of this is new. There are other cultures who have far more sort of intimate death rituals and ways of connecting and creating meaning around death, who've been doing that for centuries and continue to do those sorts of things today in their own cultures. But it really is specifically with the rise of industrialization in the West in the late 19th century, early 20th century. We've really lost our connection to death. People don't really die in the home anymore. I don't know what the actual statistic is, but well over half the people who die are dying in hospital, not in their own personal spaces. And it's really connections that we've lost in the relative recent in Western culture. And so this group of national death care workers are trying to reconnect us to some of those other traditions.
Well, I think it's wonderful that this is all happening. I did allude to before the break that I was going to talk to you about prior documentary, which is autobiographical, called The Skin I'm In. So you were found passed out, split open, with a lethal blood alcohol content on the subway tracks of Berlin.
Yeah.
People obviously have an entire documentary they can watch about that. And I did check, and it is available. It's available through Google Play. It's probably also on Amazon.com if it's on Google Play. Am I correct?
Yeah, and iTunes as well.
And iTunes. Is it on Netflix or Hulu?
It's not. It's on a great site called Fandor, though. I don't know if people know that, but a really great subscription site with art film called Fandor. It's on there.
How do you spell that?
Fandor is F-A-N-D-O-R.
Exactly how it sounds. Okay, so tell me a little bit about what happened in the premise of this film.
Well, listen, the inciting incident, me being found unconscious on the Berlin subway tracks with my head split open with a lethal blood alcohol content is really my bottom. I got to a really bad place with alcohol in 2005, and the film really, with my own journey getting sober and coming to terms with what got me to that place. And, really, drinking for me was a last stop on what was actually, now that I really look back on it, a lifelong trajectory of feeling uncomfortable in my own body and in my own life as a gay male, trying to sort of reconcile myself with the American culture in the 80s and 90s. And in sort of eschewing organized religion from my life, I kind of made the mistake of conflating religion with spirit and kind of forsaked any real personal cultivation of spirit. And so I was one of these overachieving, you know, young men who achieved steady outward success, you know, valedictorian in high school, went to an Ivy League college, got two advanced degrees, got my job as a professor. But really kind of all of that masked the fact that I hadn't really dealt with spirit. And so there was sort of a history of driving my body to extremes my entire life. Compulsive exercise, anorexia, cutting as a teenager, smoking, and then finally drinking. And so this film really starts to sort of trace that history, but sort of ask some questions about, you know, what is it? I think many of us, whether even if it's not sexuality or a journey with coming out around sexuality, I think each of us has some aspect of ourselves that that we struggle with, and perhaps are for sort of more brutal and more exacting on ourselves than others from outside or even on us. My journey in terms of trying to reconnect with my body after getting sober was to decide that I was going to do something that I think at least is kind of beautiful and permanent to a body I had exacted so many sort of fleeting and damaging things to. So I decided I was going to get a full back tattoo and collaborated with a Pacific Northwest artist who helped me to translate three Pacific Northwest animal stories and myths that resonated with me as I was trying to find some sort of sense of spiritual compass outside of organized Western religion, and an African-American tattoo artist here in Los Angeles. And together, over the course of a year and a half, got this full back tattoo put on my body. And the film sort of chronicles that real-time journey. And ultimately, I realized by the end of the making of the film, I realized I basically created a contemporary ritual for myself to sort of come of age, reconnect with some sense of spirit for myself, and reconnect to my body in a way that was sort of more loving and permanent than the trajectory I'd been on.
Wow. I just Googled Roderick Fox tattoo and images, and there it is. So,
it's out there for the world, yeah.
There it is. The whole world has your back.
Yeah.
You know, congratulations on your sobriety. I have about 14 and a half years of sobriety myself.
Congrats.
Is there anything you'd like to talk about that we haven't addressed so far in this interview?
Gosh, I feel like you asked some great questions. We've covered a lot of ground. I mean, really, for me, I guess what I'll say is, even though, certainly, just through experience and years, I can call myself a professional maker, I just really want to underscore the point that, you know, that the technology I use to make my films is increasingly, you know, either in direct access to people or at least only one or two degrees of separation away. There are some amazing films that have come out this year that people have shot on iPhones. I think that the traditional distinctions that there are professional filmmakers and then the rest of the world who are just consumers or spectators of media is really changing. And I encourage everybody to, you know, to take the means that they have at their disposal and to tell their own stories, to sort of diversify the range of stories and perspectives that we have out there. You know, a funny animal video is fun for me as much as the next guy, but, you know, I think there are ways in which sometimes the way in which we use social media, the way in which we use YouTube, the way in which we use our phones are kind of limited by some external sort of senses of what's appropriate, what's professional, what's entertaining, what's worth sharing. And a lot of those presumptions are really just culturally constructed or maybe just things that we impose on ourselves. So to go back to the idea of queering things, I would say I think people should queer their ideas about who can tell stories and who can make media and play and experiment and put your own story out there.
That's beautifully said, and it ties into my just life's purpose. My articulated mission statement is to honor and express my creativity in a way that makes a difference. And what I strive to do with my show is inspire people to identify and follow their own dreams and to express their own life force in a way that gives them the life they want and allows them to impact others.
That's great.
I want to thank you for taking the time to be on my show today, and also for just following your passion and ultimately creating the films that you have created.
It's been so great to be a guest. I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Please come on the show again.
All right. Thanks a lot, Nicholas.
You're welcome. Have a wonderful day. That was Broderick Fox of Zen and the Art of Dying. Find it at zenandtheartofdying.com. And The Skin I'm In also has a website. Google it. You'll find it. And keep your eye on Brody, because there's a lot more coming from him, I know. I'm definitely convinced of that.
We are, in fact, connecting the circuitry of humanity. All of us connected. Please continue to connect with Nicholas Snow on Facebook, Twitter, Periscope, Instagram, Google+, and other social networks. Everything Nicholas Snow is available at nicholassnow.com. For our video programming, check out nicholassnow.tv. Please subscribe to the show for free at iTunes or by downloading a podcast app from your favorite app store. This program is produced and copyrighted by Nicholas Snow Productions, LLC. Thank you for being a part of the snowstorm. We are honored by your presence.